You are listening to Eastside Radio Podcast.
Sydney was a hell of an exciting city in the 90s, pre-Olympics, pre-property boom. There was a lot of vibrancy and artistic creativity and a lot of accessibility. People could afford to live in the inner city in the pursuit of their art and still get by. That's what a lot of musicians from New Zealand did over a two-decade period, one of which was William Arthur, one of the founding members and certainly the creative nucleus of alternative Sydney band Glide. Their musical reach extended as far as Adelaide and into the home of wannabe musician Ben De Hoyt, who several decades later has waded into the world of the documentary filmmaker. And having first started this project almost 5 years ago, has now completed and is set to screen the film Disappear Here, looking at this era and this music. And he joins us now on Eastside Radio. Being in Adelaide, Ben, when did you first hear about or hear the music of William Arthur and Glide?
When the Shuffle Off to Buffalo EP was getting rotation on Triple J around 92. Uh-huh. And I was a uni student and I heard Waterfalls and I was hooked from that point.
And so were you a musician at the time too?
A burgeoning. I was in my embryonic musician stages, so I was just starting to pick up the guitar at that point, and my first attempts at songwriting were total bad ripoffs of William Arthur riffs. Seriously,
I think that's a well-worn path for most creative people: is we start with imitation before we sort of, you know, find our own formulation. Tell me though, it's a difficult kind of genre to describe this music because it's post-grunge and it's not really post-punk or funk. It really stands on its own two feet, this scene, particularly in Australia, I find.
Yeah, I'm not sure if you're up to this point in watching the film yet, but there's some commentary in there about Flying Nun and Glide being compared to Flying Nun. And, you know, when I think of Flying Nun, I think of artists like the Straitjacket Fits. I'm pretty sure they're on Flying Nun. Gosh, I hope I got that right. But it is hard to pin down what Glide did, but there was an affinity that Glide had with the Flying Nun staple. And I think that's a staple that was always kind of blessed or doomed to have a strong cult following or a strong dedicated following, but not a particularly mainstream or wide following.
Alternative, I think, is the term that we all settled on, isn't it, in the 90s? And the alternative indie scene seems to be,
yes,
the best way to describe it, but it's such a broad brushstroke. Anyway, how challenging do you think it was for William, coming from New Zealand, to adapt to a fast-paced, gritty and success-driven scene in Sydney as opposed to this more relaxed music environment in New Zealand?
My sense is that he was up for it. I've learned about a version of William, which is a mixture of what his family have shared with me and what his close friends and bandmates have shared with me. And my very strong sense is that William was up for a faster pace. He wanted to experience and explore the different cultural avenues that were available to him in a big city like Sydney. So I think he was kind of done with the slow pace of Wellington, and I think he was up for it. I think he was ready.
Is that what inspired you to make this film as well, Ben? Were you up for the challenge of trying to tell this story about Glide and the music of William Arthur?
I was definitely up for it. To be honest, if I had known at the point of commencing production on this, had I known then what I know now, I might have thought twice about making the film, because it's not a particularly happy story in a lot of ways. It's definitely not a happy story. I mean, William's not with us anymore, but there's also a lot of joy in celebrating him as a person and celebrating his music. So to be honest, if I'd known, I might not have been up for the challenge at that point. I'm glad that I proceeded. And I was definitely up for it. I was actually up for making a documentary that was less of a challenge than the music documentary I'd started making beforehand. So I actually thought this was going to be easier than what I'd been working on.
William himself is not a simple character. He's quite complex. And as a result of that, I feel like his songwriting too has also many layers and many moments surrounding each song. You must have thought that you were certainly kind of biting off more than you could. Well, not more than you could chew, but you're certainly peeling an onion here, aren't you? You're going to find more and more the longer you do this.
Yes. So, I mean, I was, you know, put it this way, I knew that this was going to be a fairly somber, dark story, but I actually didn't anticipate the depth of the complexity of navigating the telling of a story of a man who has a family who are still here,
yeah,
and bandmates and friends and partners who all had very different relationships with him. And so I was not surprised to learn about the complexities of William as a person, but the complexities and the compartmentalizations of his relationships was surprising. And and the, you know, decades later, emotional responses from people were in some ways surprising as well. And and look, part of that surprise is I haven't told a story like this before, so surprise was bound to happen. Yeah, that's the best answer I can muster for that question.
I know exactly what you mean, because I think we're about 20 minutes into the documentary and it comes up that one of the band members, Tim Scott, leaves the band, and there are other factors at play, and some of the other band members actually ask you, are you interviewing Tim at all? How did you frame the more sensitive moments of the story to elicit a truthful and honest response from the band members?
I actually made sure I had conversations with each one of them before we'd even sit down to do a filmed interview. So I let everybody know, you know, what I let, you know, Paul McDonald know and Tim Scott know, this is what I want to talk to you about. Is any of this going to be a problem? How do you feel about it? And I just built it. There was a long time in setting this up because I started shooting the film in March of 2020, which was a pretty interesting time in that it was the beginning of the pandemic. And so there was a long time before I did the interview. So it was time to do a little bit of relationship building. And so I prepared everyone as best I could and didn't throw any left hooks at them when I interviewed them.
There is a lot of joy in the story though as well, Ben, I would say. And because I'm not a fan of the whole back in the day mantra, but there seemed to be this stronger correlation in the 90s between promotion in street press, airplay on the radio, especially community radio, seeing a band live and buying their album to complete this whole music user experience. And I'm just not sure if that happens anymore.
You're correct. I don't think it does. One thing that appealed to me about telling the story and appeals to me about telling stories about the 90s is that is the last decade before we had this tech on us all the time. And our lives dominated by social media and the internet and streaming platforms, and you can instantly access everything. And the joy of discovery is largely diminished by the age of technological convenience in which we live. And so I wanted to weave a bit of a tapestry of that time in this film as well, as a reminder for the familiar who those familiar with the era, and also as a as hopefully something as a of a discovery for younger people who are not familiar with that era and want to get a sense of what the olden days were like.
I looked up their discography online as well, and I came across their 1997 album, Shrink Wrapped Real Thing, and two things stood out to me. Firstly, it was selling for almost $80, which is super rare for a CD. And secondly, the song 16 Years to Life featured Matthew Ottignon on the saxophone, and he is another New Zealand musical import and also a presenter here at this very station. So that was a lovely little connection between Glide and Eastside Radio.
Wow, that's a heck of a bit of a synchronicity right there. Yeah, there was definitely some contention around the release of Shrink Wrapped Real Thing, which would have been a bit too esoteric to go into in this documentary because I wanted to appeal to a broad audience. But just the whole conception of that EP was problematic for the band because it demonstrated for them, well, the label don't really have a lot of faith in us because they don't want us to release just an EP of new material. They want to bunch it up with legacy material. And so I know when I talked to Andy Kentler from the band about it, he basically said that was just completely ridiculous. And see, my sense is that Shrink Wrapped Real Thing, as it was conceived, was a bit of a concession for the band for a label that they felt didn't have a whole lot of faith in them.
As I mentioned before, with the label alternative, it was a period in which major music labels were throwing millions of dollars in the hope to crack that alternative market. And I know that a lot of people said that there was money to be made, but I still feel like all the money was made in the hands of the executives, and the real artists and the creatives put out, you know, a plethora of work. One of which, you know, is just sort of, I guess, rewarded by the fact that they now have a musical legacy and not so much financial remuneration.
Yes. I mean, there's an irony that if the band were signed to a major label, I quite possibly wouldn't have been able to make this film because the music would be owned by, you know, Sony or something, and it would be financially inaccessible. And you know, Peter Fenton in the film talks about this process of your music becoming no longer your music. And it seems bad looking back now. It's even worse now because original music has been further devalued by streaming platforms where, like with Spotify, if you get less than 20,000 streams, you don't even get 0.00001 cents per play. So things are actually worse than they were.
It's a wonderful documentary, Ben, and I congratulate you tremendously on pulling it all together and also telling it in a lovely way too. The interviews, you know, are beautifully interspersed between past members of the band and also just the music too. I'm loving the layers of music. I'm a huge fan of the bass lines that littered the music of Glide. Can you tell us about some of the screenings we've got here?
Yes, so thank you for your kind words. And yes, there is one more planned screening at this point, which is going to be the big one. It's going to be in Sydney, which is why we're doing this interview. It's going to be at the Ritz Randwick on Thursday, the 24th of this month, so Thursday next week.
Yep, that's a week away. Fantastic.
Yep, and it's going to be at 6:30. It will be hosted by one of the stars of the film, which is Peter Fenton from Crow. And there'll be a Q&A with myself and members of the band and the manager of the band after the film. There will also be beautiful film posters for sale at $30 a piece. And if folks want a poster, please bring cash and exact change. And there's only like 45 left. And if people want to work out where to buy tickets, you can buy them online at the Ritz Randwick website, or you'll be able to get them on the night. But it actually is selling pretty well.
That is so wonderful to hear, Ben. Listen, congratulations again on the film. And our audience knows the Ritz Cinema well. It's right in our neighbourhood. And I wish you all the best next Thursday with this wonderful film called Disappear Here.
You have been listening to Eastside Radio Podcast. For selections of more enjoyable content like this, visit our website, eastsidefm.org, and click on Podcast.